This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 19, Director versus Coach. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, the team talk about what's in a name, what's the difference between a director of cricket, a director of coaching, a coach, and a team director. We'll get to the bottom of it on this week's show, as well as answering a couple of questions. One about how you should hold your bat, and we get quite an interesting reply on that one. And one about whether you should go over or round the wicket during training. Listen in for the answers on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to better cricket, whether that's coaching or playing or anything else. You're in the right place for half an hour of audio goodness to get you better at the game. My name is David Hinchliffe and I look after things here. And joining me, as they do every week, are two very fine cricket coaches. The first is the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garras.
Hello, how are you? You all right?
Very good, thank you, yes. And second of all, it's, last but not least, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers.
Hi, David. How are you?
Good, good. And so we've already mentioned it once, and I think probably all of us can relate to this on a couple of levels. When we're talking about director of cricket, director of coaching, cricket coaches, and even the term team director that was around for a little while, it happens at the top level, and it happens at club level, and it happens at school level. And I was thinking about all these different terms for different roles within cricket. What do they mean? Is there anything in these names? Are there differences, or is it's just a fancy name for something that's been around for a long time?
Well, I don't think these type of roles have been around for a long time. It's something that's come in as I suppose hierarchy and organisational things come into play more and more within sport, and it's a direct knock-on. We talk about it quite regularly, the direct knock-on of business organisational regimes and organisational charts having an impact on sport. And it's not just in cricket, it's happening in a lot of sports, directors of football, directors of rugby and so on and so forth. I think the key thing really is to look at the job descriptions that sit underneath each, because for example, Sam is cricket professional down at Portsmouth Grammar School, but I should imagine when we look at our two job descriptions between the two of us, the fact that our role has a different sound or a different name to it, is often a bit misleading, because actually our job descriptions wouldn't be dissimilar in many ways. So that's a crucial thing for me, the job descriptions and the things that you're meant to be doing and you do on a daily basis.
Do you think, Lavers, that it's a particularly British thing? I know we've all, I think you're director of cricket at Burridge, is that right? Is that your director?
I am. I've got a few job titles, so I'm cricket professional at the grammar school. I'm also head of the cricket academy, which is a new initiative that we started about 3 years ago.
Okay. And then director
at Burridge, I am director of cricket. So there are a few different job titles and obviously the job description is the key bit, so that's the bit I actually do. I think it's often striving for a little bit of clarity in someone's role to have a different version of it and make sure it's kind of clear to everyone looking at it what it is, when actually a director of cricket at one place is very different to a director of cricket at another place. So in a effort to try and gain clarity as to what someone's specific role is, whether it is head coach, cricket professional, director of cricket coaching, director of coaching, all the different permutations that are effectively a jumble of four or five words in a slightly different order. In doing that, they're all very similar, and it doesn't really give anyone much clarity at all, because no one knows what each one really is. So the idea behind it is good, to make sure people know what their role is within a business or an organisation, but within cricket, it's not necessarily quite as clear as you'd like.
So as a general rule, what would we say the differences were between, say, head coach and director of coaching I mean, it's hard to be specific about these things. So let's just say as general rules, what would you say generally are the differences?
Well, I'd say head coach is a term that's given when people haven't got a significant amount of support staff around them. So therefore, they are leading the coaching process on a day-to-day basis. If you look at an example of team director for it, in this case was Andy Flower, wasn't it? Team director with England. He had a team of coaches and specialists that he would direct. And obviously he would then be the director linking in with the captain, which was Alistair Cook or Andrew Strauss at the time. So he would be the sort of the guy that put it all together. But in a case of a head coach, it's normally because you've got yourself on your own or maybe one or two other coaches around you rather than a huge team because you'd be leading the coaching process. So that's my interpretation of it. That's my understanding of the job descriptions that sat beneath head coach, as Pete Moores was, to team director that Andy Flower was. Certainly Pete had less support staff than Andy did. It was only a couple less, but it certainly was a lesser number.
And so looking at higher levels, just thinking about the way that international teams are structured around the world, it does seem to be peculiar to English cricket to have directors in charge of the coaching, whereas in a lot of other countries it tends to revolve around head coach rather than a director of coaching. So do you think it is a peculiarly British thing, or do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's good thing if you've got the right person in place, and certainly whilst Hugh Morris was doing the job in England, it was very much the right person in place, and I believe that they've got a really good person in Andrew Strauss now. So I think having that level of person to sit up on top and have a holistic view, I think, and a more global view, because sometimes when you're working in a highly competitive environment, your aim is purely on the next game. It's not on what lies ahead, and it's not on the strategic planning as such, particularly when you're under as much pressure as somebody like Pete Moores was under as England head coach. You know, you're going from game to game, really, whereas the job that sits above that person is one to look at the four-year cycle, to look at how players are developing, to look at the national coaching setup in Loughborough in this case, but in South Africa it will be at their high performance centre. In Australia it will be up on the Gold Coast where they've got their academy set up, and seeing how that all dovetails in. It's also looking at succession planning for players and also for coaches. So that's the role that Andrew Strauss has taken on board, and also how the domestic game fits in with the international game. So all of those things are really important to these guys, and that's what their job's going to be. Whereas the head coach, which I should imagine Jason Gillespie or whoever comes in will take over, will be working with the day-to-day stuff and really about winning game to game, as opposed to having too much of a long-term plan.
And how do you see it, Lavers, at the high level? I know you look on from a distance rather than being directly involved in that higher level stuff, international level stuff, but How do you see that shift in roles in other countries, say in the way that India do things or the way that Australia do things?
It is interesting, and everyone does have a slightly different variation on a structure that they think is going to be the most effective way to effectively build a cricket team and build a country playing cricket. I'd be very interested to see if there is any great benefit to the changes that we make over the changes that Australia make, and how being led, I would think that being led by an overall director in the way that England is pretty important to what is as Gareth said there, a long-term plan, and there's a lot more than just the actual game going on the field. So I imagine there are people who are in charge of that in other countries. However, their job title may not seem as prominent. So I'd be very surprised if there aren't all the jobs being done in India or South Africa or Australia that are being done in England and vice versa. It's just how they're dressed up and the job title that's put on top of the person who's in charge of those. So ultimately, all those job descriptions that make up all the different jobs that are being done are probably going to come out with the same things being done in the end. And before long, they will be anyway. So if someone's doing something well that other people aren't doing, you'll see the other countries start to follow quite quickly. So, yeah, it's just how they fall under different titles is the main change rather than the actual work being done, I think.
And sometimes I think that, you know, although names are very important, sometimes you can get wrapped up in that, and it's really a matter of, like you said, Lavers, to make sure that the job is getting done and the structure is in such a way that the best people have the best chance of doing the best for the level that they're playing. And if you can get that right, it doesn't, you know, the structure is right, then what the name of the person is doing, it doesn't matter so much, does it?
Absolutely. I mean, that within organisations and with bigger cricketing organisations or business organisations, obviously there is a demand for a job title to reflect a salary band or a role of responsibility or number of people that you're managing, and they have preset restrictions or limitations which will dictate what your title is going to be. But obviously with most within cricket, for instance, at school here, the job title I have is reasonably irrelevant now, because the more I'm here, I'm kind of doing my own job and leading it sort of personally with a few other members of staff. And if we add something to the role, it doesn't really change the job title. It'll just be what it is, really. I remember having a chat with Gareth about 6 months ago about this, and his was a fairly straight answer, is that he's the cricket guy and I am the cricket guy. You're the cricket yeah. guy at that place, and that's pretty much what you do.
Yeah, that's a nice way of summing it up, really, isn't it? I mean, well said, Gary. It's not like you to talk straight.
Keep it simple, mate. When you got simple people like me around, you need to keep it simple.
Get on with it.
Correct.
Okay, let's finish up this section with a yes-no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no to, no matter how much more that the team want to say. I've got the questions, so let's fire away. First question. Forget the fielders, and all you see are gaps.
Yep.
Second question. Wicketkeepers have to be the position most resilient to mistakes.
No.
Third question. It's impossible to recreate match pressure in training.
No.
At this point of the show, we answer some listeners' questions. So a couple of people have sent in some questions to us, and we will do our best to answer those. The best questions of the week will also win a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can send your questions into us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, or we've got some other ways to get in touch with us towards the end of the show, including the phone number. And the first question is from Mitchell. And Mitchell says, I've got a quick question about how and where I should hold my bat whilst I'm in my stance waiting for the bowler to deliver the ball. I've been struggling to find a comfortable technique when I'm facing up. I've been watching blokes like Peter Hanscom, who hold it up to their shoulder, and others like Brad Hodge, who have it held pretty much on the ground. I've been told to hold in whichever way feels comfortable by my club and school coaches, but I'm struggling to find a way. Do you have any tips on this?
Yeah, I have a couple of tips, and it doesn't go too far off what you've already been told, which is, everybody will have their own preference. But I think in order to work on their own preference, there's two ways of going about it. The first one is to ask somebody who watched you when you first started playing the game what you did. So that could be your parents are often good, or your best mates, or the guys that have been around you a lot are often good to get as a reference point. I think in years to come, we'll probably have more video around of youngsters playing the game for the first time. So that would be a good reference point. But not everybody's got that, obviously. So ask people around you how you set up when you first started batting. And then the other thing to do is to have a little go at all three. And you've mentioned two of them. But to me, you've got that high back, sort of preemptive backswing thing. That some people have, and we saw Graham Gooch, who's one of our coaches on pitch vision that employed that particular method when he batted a very raised bat before letting it drop and letting it come down. And secondly, you talked about the Brad Hodge method where the bat's on the ground. We see that deployed around the world really well. Somebody like Adam Gilchrist did it fantastically well as a batter, you know, averaging 50 in both forms of a game, 50 plus in both forms of a game. And starting with his bat on the ground or very close to the ground. And then you have people like Ricky Ponting that had that neutral position. And that neutral position is where your hands really are a level with your cricket box. And as your body unwinds and you step and swing, your hands go back and start that movement process. So I'm watching two players out in the middle here at the moment playing a game for the Mayors 11 at school, and one has a low back lift and does with his hands in a neutral position and does a step and swing, and the other one has his bat a bit higher before that process starts. So I would have a go at all three, but my starting point with any player who's unsure will always be to go to the neutral position where the hands are around box level, and then the step and swing comes into play and away you go, because actually biomechanically that is the most consistent method that people start off with. So give that a go. If it doesn't work, eliminate that. Try the next one. If that doesn't work, eliminate that. And then have a go at the third one, which is the Brad Hodge. Compare and contrast, I think, is always important. Compare and contrast how it feels, what your outcome was like, how you were able to move, and you'll come up with your own decision. But if you've got a bit of a matrix around those variables and those things that you can assess, then I think you'll get to your end result and picking the one that is a preference because it feels the best to you.
Lavers, when you work with players with this kind of a problem, how much do you get them experimenting, you know, over a period of sessions? Like how long do you do it for, I guess, is my question.
Probably going to depend on the time of the year. So if someone's having an issue and it's in the middle of the cricket season, it's quite difficult to be experimenting over a period of 4 or 5 weeks when there are obviously games going on once a week, twice a week, three times a week, depending on what level of cricket they're playing and what their involvement is at the time. I've had a couple of guys who've been had a bit of an issue with timing in the winter, and they've got caught up in seeing people bat different ways on television and trying to mimic that, which a lot of young guys do. And as a result, they're moving away from what is their strength or what is their method that has been successful for them. And they're trying to mimic someone else, which is not always a bad thing. But sometimes there are some things that are very personal to you. So I'd try and get them back. And some people will very quickly realise that actually there's a method that suits them better. We had one guy who probably went for 4 or 5 weeks of trialing different things, and he'd hit 50 or 60 balls each way each time, and still a bit of umming and ahhing. And some people are very decisive with how they feel as batters, and some people need a little bit more time. But it's going to depend on the time of the year and the time scale you're working to, depending on when your performances are coming up.
And I guess as well, we were talking about free play last week, weren't we, Gareth? I mean, it's a good... Maybe it's a good time when you're just messing around a bit in the nets and you've had a proper net session, and then you and some mates are just faffing around with a tennis ball afterwards. It wouldn't be that bad of an idea just to try a couple of different things just to see how they feel.
Exactly right. No, and that's the time to do it, isn't it? And often people feel a bit more relaxed in those environments than necessarily working with a coach in a designated session. So absolutely right. I think it's a good one. And also you've got the feedback option of getting from your mates what they're seeing and what they're feeling from the experience themselves as well, and that's often a good starting point, particularly if you've got somebody there who's seen you over a period of time, because you might try one of them and they'll go, yeah, that reminds me of when you did this and when you did that. So I'm a big fan of it, as you very well know, the whole free play thing, mate, and I think this is a great thing to have a go at, so why don't you give it a go?
Yeah, kids don't need any excuse to try different things, do they? They want to copy what they're seeing on the telly, or they want to experiment with different things. It's, you know, it's a natural thing to do, and outside of that formal environment, it's just a fantastic way to do it. Next question is from Tanya, and Tanya says, Should I choose to go around the wicket or over the wicket during a net session, or bowl half of my deliveries from each side? Now, that's quite an interesting question to me, because I have a bowler I'm working with at the moment who pretty much flat refuses to bowl round the wicket at all ever because, quote, I don't do that. So that's an interesting challenge for me. So I'm interested in the feedback from both of you chaps on exactly what we should do to help Tanya.
Yeah, well, I think you've got to look at what your reasonings are for doing one or the other. And obviously, it will depend to a degree on what type of bowler you are, what conditions you're bowling in. But in terms of developing skills and expanding the options you've got, it's always useful to have practiced both methods. A lot of people do seem to be very closed off to bowling around the wicket. And similarly, you get some young cricketers who bowl around the wicket and find they're more successful in doing that in how they're landing the ball and actually don't like coming back over the wicket. Ultimately, you've got to remember that the success you get in training isn't as worth as much as the success you're going to get in a game, because it's preparation for a game. So when it comes to a game, you want to have as many options up your sleeve as you can do. And some batters will feel very comfortable against a certain type of bowler from over or round. So being able to have that level of adaptability is going to help. So I would look to do both. Obviously, we're not quite sure what you're actually bowling, so what your method is. But if you were a spinner, and it could be highly likely that you're a spin bowler, then utilisation of over and round is pretty key. And as you see, if you're a swing bowler, and people like Jimmy Anderson these days utilising over the wicket, round the wicket, positions on the crease as well, so close to the stumps and a little bit wider on the stumps, is becoming a more and more valuable and common skill in the game in a way of disrupting the batsman's angles and their perception of where the ball's going to go. So I would encourage doing both. If you're not good at something, you don't just close it off. So it's the same with batting or trying to bowl a different type of delivery. You don't just close off something you can't do. You've got to try and work at it. And these things don't happen straight away. But if you can try and mirror what you're doing round the wicket, over the wicket, or vice versa, then it's just going to give you another option.
How do you balance going over and round the wicket with bowlers, Gareth?
I think it's all down to context, really. And I think we get similar context within net situations, particularly on grass. If you're able to practice on grass wickets, which I know a lot of people, particularly in the subcontinent and the southern hemisphere, get to do probably more often than we do in the northern hemisphere. But if you get to go on grass, the grass conditions change. So, you know, if you're looking at a seamer, for example, you might not be getting too much movement off a deck on a real flat wicket. You can practice with old balls, which again changes the context. And somebody like Malcolm Marshall would always practice going around the wicket. So when there was no lateral movement from through the air or off a pitch, and let's be honest, that didn't happen too often for him, but when it did happen, he'd go around the wicket to create an angle on a right-handed batter, and also to create an angle on a left-handed batter, which would bring different types of dismissals into play. And the same for spinners as well. You get spinners to bowl on wickets that, when the wicket comes up, which is going to grip a little bit more. Bowling around the wicket to both right-handers and left-handers to bring LBWs into play for right-hander, and also to be able to pitch the ball on the line of the stumps to straighten and hit the line of the stumps from a left-handed perspective as well. So to me, it's building the context and then therefore the understanding of what you can do to create a positive outcome for yourself, or more likely to create a positive outcome for yourself as a bowler. So I always look for context rather than just getting people to practice over and around. I try and build the understanding of why you would do so, rather than just seeing it as an exercise to see whether I can actually do it. Because if people have an intention of why they're doing stuff, it generally they take it on board quicker, and also they find it more relevant when it comes to then applying it in a match.
So if you're in a situation where it's a session where no one's bowled around the wicket at all, and you think maybe that there might be a good opportunity for someone to learn something, you would bring it in a contextual way rather than just saying, right, for the next 10 balls I want.
Yeah, correct. And even when they're bowling at targets, I'll do that as well, because I'll get them to visualise. So, or for example, you could have a situation where your off-spinner's bowling. Here's a context. Your off-spinner's bowling is struggling to really connect with their action. One of the things I often do is give them the option of going around the wicket, because then they have to work really hard with their action to get the ball to a right-hander in particular to pitch in the right place. And often by getting them into their action and working their action hard, when they then go back over the wicket to a right-hander, their action is working in a more effective fashion and they actually end up bowling quite well. So again, there's another context. And I think if we're really aware of our net practices, and we're really, and we can use visualization and we can use match context, I'll try and develop it as best as possible, because I think it's really important that people understand why they're doing things. If they get that right, then they'll make better decisions out in the middle. So yeah, the more contextual I can make these things, the better.
And now we have the soapbox. What is that, you might be asking, if you're a first-time listener? Well, the answer is that it's 60 seconds on the clock. It's one of the members of the team, and they can talk about any cricket-related topic that's on their mind at the moment, and nobody can interrupt them. It's their free minute, and this week it's Sam Lavery. So, Lavers, over to you for the soapbox.
Yesterday, I was did a little bit of work with the Royal Navy, just as sort of a bit of a consultant for the 2020 stuff they've got coming up, and just talked to them a little bit about what they'd like to do and how they'd like to do it. And one of the big things that was obvious is that they wanted to achieve great things, and they wanted players to make big improvements in lots and lots of areas. So we talked about creating what we called a shopping list, and we just said, look, let's have a look at things in our shopping list. Let's write all the things down. Before long, it became very clear that the shopping list was enormous. There were all these things we wanted to do. All the players wanted to add 6 or 7 things to their game, but the time frame wasn't particularly long. So one thing we talked about with our shopping list was how we can refine it and make it a little bit more realistic. And holding an element of realism was absolutely vital. So rewriting it and looking at how we're going to develop, it's key that you have an element of realism for the timescale you've got, the facilities and the support you've got available, to make sure you can get everything on that list. And some things on there aren't too expensive or too unachievable in the time frame. And you can actually come out with a good result rather than aiming for the stars and achieving nothing.
Oh, that's fabulous. I like that. The power of a list. It's a very, you, very powerful tool.
You love a list.
Oh, I've got lists of lists. That's what I got.
Oh, you love a list. He's Mr. List Man.
If it hasn't got a checkbox, I'm not interested. And that is just about all we've got time for on the show this week. We are finishing up, but before we go, we're going to decide on the winner of this week's prize, which is, of course, if you remember, the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. Lots of videos, workbooks, ebooks, and all other kind of learning tools that you can get your teeth into if you want to improve your cricket coaching or your cricket playing. So, Gareth, we had Mitchell's question about holding the bat, and we had Tanya's question about going around the wicket or over the wicket. Which one did you prefer this week?
Yeah, again, two great questions. Well done, both of you. This week I'm going to go for Tanya, because I think it's a great question. And as coaches, we've got to keep finding ways to get people to bowl around the wicket and over and be adaptable in a contextual way. So I loved it.
Brilliant. Congratulations, Tanya. You can have a look through the archive of courses that we've got there at pitchvision.com and decide on the one that you want to go for. There's lots of bowling stuff there, very exciting videos that you can have a look at. Now, Gareth, if somebody wanted to have their chance to win that prize and also get their question answered by the team, how could they get in touch with us?
They could give us a call, David, on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right, there are lots of other ways as well. Social media is a great way to get through to us. Facebook is facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. You can join in the discussion there, have a look at the videos, send us a message privately or post something on the wall, whatever you want to do. It's all open there. You can also tweet us at pitchvisionacad. Obviously, 140 characters in your question there, otherwise you're going to be in trouble, but we'll accept those, no problem. And if you want to listen to this show every week, then you can subscribe very easily. Just go into the app on your phone or your tablet or your computer and do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us in there. Just tap on that subscribe button. And if you want to listen to the show by streaming on your computer, you can do so on any Mac or PC with an internet connection just by heading over to pitchvision.com/academy and clicking on the podcast link, and you can stream it there, or you can download the file directly on your computer, or you can subscribe in one of the feeds, or you can even get links to all the apps that we're in. So if you're thinking which podcast app should I use, we've got links to lots of different apps there, paid and free. So there's no excuse not to listen every week. We're very glad that you come along for the ride. And that's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavis.
Cheers, fellas.